Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
And this is Dan Abuhoff.
And you're here with Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper. It's Sunday,
June 25th,
2017, Vivian Watson Granger's 92nd birthday.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Today's the day.
My mom's birthday. Yeah.
Tams is just returning from several days in Atlanta to celebrate that occasion.
Yes, it was quite a festive several days, including tornado warnings, etc. So, really.
And it was marked by Tamsin's baking a spectacular chocolate cake that she did not bring back even a piece of to her husband when she returned on Friday.
So, you know, I mean, it is bikini time. So, you know, I'm probably doing you a favor.
Not for me, you know. Yeah. Okay, fine. So, to catch things up, first of all, just the final fallout from the Tony Awards is that we did pick up an article in the Times observing which player musical got the most bounce from the Tony Awards. The most bounce.
Like an uptick in sales.
Exactly right. Right? Okay. And the answer, surprisingly, is Oslo. And why do we say that's surprising? Because generally speaking, traditionally, the bounce goes to the musicals who get to put on a musical number from their show. And even quite apart from winning an award, that's what gets people excited. And people in Ohio or Indiana or wherever say, gee, that's a nice musical number. That's a catchy tune. And let's go.
But what's the point if there aren't any tickets?
Well, it's not, well, put that aside.
Evan Hansen
would have gotten a bounce if they had. But curiously, though, there was no scene from Oslo was shown, let alone a musical number. And I can only imagine that people were intrigued by the subject matter of Oslo and what they were doing there.
You know what? Here's the fallacy of it.
Yeah.
I think the bounce was really due to our podcast.
That would be the unexplained reason that the Times would be blissfully unaware of.
Yes. So
it's
nice that they think it was from the Tonys.
Yeah.
But what was there in the Tonys to really encourage
there wasn't.
That?
There was nothing. It was only us. All right. So since we're tastemakers, we feel compelled to talk about the latest thing we've seen, which is a movie called Beatrice, last night at the movie theater.
Beatrice at Dinner.
Oh, I'm sorry. Beatrice at Dinner. Yes. Beatrice at Dinner with Selma Hayek and John Lithgow.
With who?
John Lithgow. Selma Hayek. Keep up. So what do you think of the movie?
I was underwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was not riveting and a little confusing. At the same time, it was kind of, not surprising.
Yeah, well,
I mean, there were sort of some stereotypical.
Well, 2 seconds of background. This is a Selma Hayek character is a salt of the earth Mexican healer who lives in California. She's a wonderful massage therapist, and she helps
patients
who are suffering from cancer and others. And they juxtapose that character with these privileged, over-consuming California land barons, if you will, or at least robber barons, who live in this spectacular housing.
In a gated community,
and make their money, by all appearances, by raping the land and celebrate that by overindulging in drink and food and whatever. And so Selma Hayek, no surprise, comes out a little better by comparison with these folks. But that's not enough to really sustain the movie, it turns out, at least not for me. There is, and you look this up, Hams, and there's a leitmotif of reincarnation in the movie.
Right. So the movie is directed by Miguel Arteta and written by Mike White. And Mike White, I don't really know him, but seems he worked on School of Rock, mm-hmm. Dawson's Creek, a lot of things that everybody else knows about.
Right.
Okay, but it turns out he is actually a believer in reincarnation. He's buddies with Shirley MacLaine.
That's off-putting right there.
So we see this in the movie.
Yeah.
We see this in the movie. That
there's a reincarnation theme.
Right.
We didn't understand the Shirley MacLaine connection going in. We might have seen something else. But the fact of the matter is that, so what are we dealing with? We're dealing with what we'll call magical realism. And all right, that's not necessarily my thing. But my rule in that connection is that if we're not going to use real logic, we have to have something that has its own internal logic. And there are three categories of films or books or whatever with respect to internal logic. One are those which strictly adhere to that internal logic. Two would be those which try to adhere to that internal logic and somehow fail. And three would be those which don't even care to try, don't even give it a shot. Just say, you know, how do you like that sunset?
I'm guessing you feel this falls into not even trying.
Well, there's no guessing involved. But that's what it was. So it's several bricks short of a movie, but, you know, nice performance by Selma Hayek and John Lithgow. Just not enough to sustain.
I think if you if your values align with Selma Hayek, and she is very much, you know, an animal saving person, she actually has some property in, I think, Washington State, where with rescue animals and so on and so forth. Then I think it means more to you.
I think it means more, and I think you go to the movie wanting it to succeed, except the movie doesn't succeed.
And so, you did note that the characters are drawn in such a way that they are not totally just cartoon-like stereotypes.
It's a very good performance by Lithgow and Hayek. I mean, they do very well. So they carry you through much of the movie, but it's still a thumbs down.
And the only funny thing is that I was reading an interview with Hayek about making the movie and about being an actress at her age. She just turned 50. And one of the things she mentioned was she was thinking about, you know, being an older actress. She was remembering when she was a teenager, she read a play called The Doll's House.
Yeah.
And she always wondered what happened to Nora after she left.
Well, now she knows.
And now she knows.
Now she knows.
And so, you know, a couple weeks ago, I was saying, whoever wondered about that? Who even
knew? Well, now she can know if she sees Dollhouse 2 on Broadway.
Right, right.
And
which was written for people like Selma.
Somebody would have let her know.
That could, which I didn't even know.
Run that down. Okay, in the news the last couple of weeks, the Amazon acquisition of Whole Foods. And the Times has been reflecting what other papers have been thinking about or writing about over the past few weeks. There's two ways to look at this. And overwhelmingly, I think a lot of the articles have been some trepidation. What's going to happen to the cashiers is really those stories. I mean, Amazon's buying this. Everything's changing. And those cashier jobs are going to go. Is this the direction society wants to go? You're seeing a little of that, and the Times has been writing about that.
I mean, people have to keep in mind that Whole Foods has slashed their staff over the last few years by tremendous amounts.
But the concern is that they would slash it even more.
Yeah.
But that, to me, is a highly negative way to look at it. To the Times' credit, they have another article by someone who's a little more economically oriented, who has a broader view of things. And what that person's saying, like, hold your horses here. I mean, you have in the grocery segment a huge fail. I mean, it's one of the segments in the economy that just performs poorly. It's terribly inefficient. It's terribly wasteful. What do I mean by that? And what does the Times mean by that? They mean that when you go shopping, your experience takes you a long time. And part of the reason it takes you a long time is that you are forced to look at hundreds of products in which you have no interest.
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason, you know, Americans, they have statistics, spend an hour or 2 hours, whatever, a week shopping when they could spend a third of the time shopping. Number two is there's a lot of waste in supermarkets. And what I mean by that is a lot of food gets thrown out because they're constantly bringing all this stuff, the trucking from all over the place, and they just can't coordinate in such a way that they can manage how much food is going to be preserved and how much food is just not going to make it. And that leads to a lot of fossil fuels and whatever in terms of trucking and so on. So there's a lot that can be done in this area. And what's exciting in some people's views is that somebody like Bezos, the head of Amazon, is going to take a flyer on this. And not that he has a simple solution, a turnkey solution, but he has tremendous resources. They have tremendous background and sophistication around delivery of goods and services, be it warehousing or whatever. And you could have, and they imagine, a shopping experience where you walk in and there's an analysis of your pupil, which tells the store right away what products you'd like to see or not
see.
They're presented to you right away. You go tick, 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 nick, and those things are delivered to you. And there's some variance. And look, there's a lot of room for improvement. And this could be the answer to that. Well, you saw an article about how tough delivery
is.
Well,
this is funny. This is a funny thing. I was talking to my brother and my mother this weekend, and we were remembering that back when you're watching, like, I Love Lucy.
Right.
And sometimes they needed groceries.
Yeah.
And they would call down to the store.
Right.
And order from the guy, from the grocer.
Right.
And then have it delivered by somebody. And I remember, you know, growing up in the 60s, how is that possible? You know, I couldn't imagine.
It's possible, but
that
it's
you
still,
could do that.
But it's still,
you know,
terribly inefficient.
Yeah, but now you can do that. I mean, getting online and clicking on things is really the same thing. And you have somebody in a warehouse picking out the produce for you, just as the grocery used to do that.
But generally speaking...
So we've come back around to that.
But generally speaking, and I know you looked at an article from The Life of the Delivery Man, but generally speaking, it doesn't work well. It's considered a failure. It's considered an effort that's only scratched the surface into the people who might be interested in delivery, because delivery is just so hit and miss. That's the problem, and I think Bezos could be part of the solution.
Well, the delivery has many aspects to it, and it's pretty complicated. As the New York Times states, delivering food requires military precision.
Right.
Bananas can't get cold.
Right.
Produce can't get warm.
Exactly.
Eggs, of course, must not be broken, and people expect their food to arrive at specific times.
Right.
So you might have a truck that's refrigerated, but then you have to protect things like the bananas from getting cold, because they will turn black, and they'll be fine, but they won't look good. So it is very complicated, and this article follows a fellow named Sinclair Brown, who delivers in New York City and Jersey City in the urban area, New York area. And it's a hard project between the traffic. Imagine just having to, I have a hard enough time parking to do one thing in New York. Imagine parking and parking and parking and double parking and getting tickets and having to finesse doormen and get up to apartments and do all of that. So it's kind of complicated, but he does get good tips, and he, you know, he likes the money, but he works hard for the money. There's no question about that.
But an article about those challenges just underscores how it is that there's room for improvement. And someone or some organization is willing to invest. And we've talked about how much Amazon is willing to experiment and possibly fail, and all for finding a new paradigm.
I mean, that's
with
the beauty.
Respect
they
to
are
distribution.
Willing to experiment. Well, so, who do you think orders food online? Orders groceries.
Older
online?
People.
Actually, the Gen X makes up about half of Peapod's customers.
Really?
So, Gen X. Do you know who that is? That
no.
would be people born mid '60s to like the, you know, late 70s, early 80s.
Kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
But not super kids. Kids a little bit older than our kids.
Right.
Okay. Then a quarter of their customers are millennials and Generation Y, which would be anybody like born after 80 to 95. Yeah. And then there's another quarter of, and the remaining 25% are older people. Now, we have found it's a boon to very much older people, because they can't get out. They can't get to the store.
Right.
So that's terrific that somebody can bring everything to them. But again, it's a complicated phenomenon.
Well, look, you know, I think the idea, the bottom line is, we have to move on to another subject, but the bottom line is that, you know, to say, gee, that's kind of a worrisome acquisition, because maybe the cashiers are going to lose their jobs. It's sort of like complaining about, you know, what's going to happen to the manufacturers of buggy whips now that we see the introduction of the automobile. I mean, it's just, you have to look at it in a more broad-minded way. I think you had another article on
business is changing in a lot of different ways. And in the Times book review section, there is a review by Walter Isaacson about several different books that detail all these changes, you know, how these changes in technology, how these changes in business have come about, and following the stories of Airbnb and Uber, especially, and, you know, trying to examine what are they doing, who are the guys who created this, how did they get there, and of course, you know, Uber is going through tremendous challenges at the moment. And what Isaacson comes down to, and he does state, you know, Uber and Airbnb, as embodied by their young billionaire leaders, represent a radical expansion of freedom and a liberating empowerment of individuals to supply services as they please without government intervention. Okay. On the other hand, critics blame them for everything from destroying the basic rules of employment, exacerbating traffic, ruining peaceful neighborhoods, bringing unrestrained capitalism into liberal cities. But what he also mentions that the concept of work is changing. You've heard this phrase,
right.
Gig economy.
Right.
People are going from like project to project as opposed to full-time employment, etc. And he says what these books that he's reviewing show is that societies must find ways to absorb these economic transformations because it is futile to resist them. Okay. Peer-to-peer technology may be disruptive. Its effects can be messy, but it has an inexorable tendency to empower people to find and produce new offerings that improve our lives by reinforcing that most basic rule of entrepreneurship, which is to make something people really want.
Yeah. Look, I mean, we're looking forward to see what Amazon does. I mean, they have an opportunity to address what could be a slew of market inefficiencies. They might be the organization best equipped to do it. And we'll look forward to seeing what they come up with.
And there was another article in the Times this week about the value of failure.
Right.
In creating business.
Well, let's
just say, guys, failure is in.
Failure.
To all of you who have experienced nothing but ongoing success after success, I feel sorry for you, but now failure is where it's at.
Yeah, well, let's hope Amazon doesn't fail. So another thing that's kind of stunned me, well, here's another thing. Here's something that stunned me in the paper. Headline in the Times, Stephon Marbury stars as himself in Chinese hoops biopic.
Biopic, I think.
Biopic? I don't know.
They say it in America.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, I was using the Chinese pronunciation. The point is that putting the headline talk aside, Stephon Marbury is the subject of a movie in China.
I don't know. First of all,
you have to appreciate that my world was rocked when I saw this. So who is Stephon Marbury and why are we shocked by this? Stephon Marbury is a basketball player.
Oh, really?
Who played in the NBA from 1996 to something like 2010. And at the age of 32 or 33, when his career in the NBA hit a downturn, went to China. And
did he play for any teams I know?
I'm going to come to that.
Okay.
Just hold your horses there. So when he got to the, he left for China. And he has been, according to this article, tremendously successful in China and revered. In China. There is a statue of him in Beijing.
A statue.
I'm not making this up. And he's now the subject of a movie. The Times helpfully observes that there have been others. The Times writes stuff in this naive way. I love the way they do this. There have been other sports figures that have been memorialized in movies. They tell us about Gary Cooper playing Lou Gehrig in Pride of the Yankees. Babe Ruth was in a movie. Jackie Robinson. Et cetera, et cetera. The difference between Jackie Robinson and Lou Gehrig and Stephon Marbury is that people like those guys, okay? Here's the problem with Stephon Marbury, and here's the mystery, okay? Stephon Marbury left the NBA as, you know, somewhat reviled figure or close to it.
For what?
Let me explain. He comes out of a Georgia Tech after 1 year in about 1996, I guess, was his first year in the pros. And he is a huge prospect, a huge talent, most often compared to Allen Iverson, just as quick but a little taller. He gets drafted in the NBA, and he is such a legend. He is traded immediately for Ray Allen. Ray Allen, who people talk about now going to the Hall of Fame, the trade is Ray Allen plus a first-round draft pick.
Oh, wow.
For Stephon Marbury.
Yeah.
Ray Allen is the subject of, I was talking to you before about the movie He Got Game with Spike Lee. He plays a character who is a legendary high school player. In that movie, Ray Allen's character refers to the legend Stephon Marbury.
Okay.
And the character goes, get this, to Lincoln High School, where Stephon Marbury went to high school. In other words, Ray Allen's not that well known. He gets to play Stephon Marbury. I mean, okay. Stephon Marbury right. is yeah. a legend, right. and it doesn't exactly work out. He starts out on the Minnesota team, the Timberwolves. They get to a rough patch. And if you go back into the archives a little bit, you find that there have been some pretty harsh articles about Stephon Marbury as his career went on. He went to the Nets and didn't really succeed. He got traded for Jason Kidd at some point, by the way. And then he went to the Knicks. But just to pull an article out of the air, a 2006 article in the Daily News talking about the one-time schoolboy hero may now be the most reviled athlete in New York. Right?
But was he reviled just because
I'll tell you, fans no longer cheer him. They see him as a cancer in the locker room, an overpaid malcontent. The words, I'm reading from the article, the words excellence and commitment are tattooed on Marbury's body, a constant reminder that he displays neither.
Does he literally have those tattoos?
Yes. Yes. They tell one story as an exemplar, okay? About a coach giving a pep talk to the team. Lenny Wilkins was the coach of the Knicks then. And Marbury, follows it up with his own speech, repeating most of the coach's message, exhorting the team to play with vigor and passion, using profanity, etc. And here's the quote. When he was finished, the Knicks took the floor for practice with one exception. Marbury remained in the locker room for a massage. This was his persona. And then at the age of 32, a basketball player slowed down. Marbury, no exception, but still probably good enough to play in the NBA. But nobody wanted him. And as a result, in 2010, when he announces he's going to China, there's an article in the Wall Street Journal in which it's quoted the president of U.S. Basketball Academy, whose experience with Chinese teams, quote, if Marbury lasts 10 days, I'll be amazed. I mean, in other words, Marbury is the poster child for what some would say is the, over-entitled, difficult to deal with, the bad NBA sort. They're not all that way, but that's
he has great success. He lasts more than 10 days.
That's the thing that's crazy. So you say to yourself, here's this guy's his malcontent. He goes to China, and now they're making movies about him. They have a statue about him. What happened? Was it Eastern religion? The Times suggests that might have been it. Was it collectivism, just a way of thinking about it? That might be it. But there's one other explanation. It's the traditional explanation in basketball. It's got to be the shoes. It's the shoes. Marbury has his own brand of shoes. They're called Starbury shoes. And he took them with him to China. He sells them in the U.S., but China is a much bigger distribution market than the U.S. As a matter of fact, for example, people in China have purchased more cars last year than U.S. and Japan combined. It's a very big market, and it's a big market for basketball shoes.
It all comes down to
not. And here's the only evidence we have on that. So Marbury, now at the age of 40, all right, the Statesman, is asked about Lonzo Ball. Lonzo Ball just got drafted, second in the NBA draft. And there's been a big fuss about him because his father, LeVar Ball, is viewed by some as quite a difficult person, has demanded a $1 billion contract for his son to do a shoe contract, and he wants his own name on it. He's been much criticized. But Marbury has actually called the Ball family and said, maybe we can do distribution in China. And here's what Marbury had to say about the situation. He said, Lonzo has the chance to be a really good basketball player. And this is a quote, by the way. With that being said, Lonzo controls what is going to happen. He creates an infrastructure with different social networks and platforms to utilize those channels to sell his product. If he is playing well and doing well, people will support his family. A lot of people are going to pass judgment on how LeVar is delivering the message, but if you listen to everything he's saying, it makes sense for him to create his own brand. So it's been a long trip since Lincoln High School. for Stefan Marbury. And, you know, maybe it's not collectivism. Maybe it's capitalism. But I let me put it this way. I want to see that movie. I want to see that Stefan Marbury movie when it
really?
Comes out
to Montgomery Theater. You report back.
I will. Oh, you're not going?
Yeah. I haven't heard anything that I find really compelling. I was looking for more, you know, dirt.
I don't have any dirt.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're moving on. To gastro something.
Gastrophysics.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, actually there was an article, a review of a book called Gastrophysics by Charles Spence, again examining what makes food taste good. And the reviewer actually questions the word gastrophysics because it's not really physicists working on this, but psychologists, marketers, designers, behavioral economists, and chefs. And it seems like kind of a fun book examining what makes things taste good, why we think things taste good, how people behave. Turns out when people watch Food Network shows, after they're over, they run out. They don't buy healthy food. They actually buy junk food. The idea being that they're so sort of overstimulated by what they've been watching on TV. They just, impulsively want junk food instead. Also, again, interesting note about people ordering tomato juice on airplanes. Turns out, because on airlines, when they're going down that aisle, about 27% of the people order tomato juice. Yeah. Nowhere else in life is it that
but there's
percentage?
A reason for it.
And that is because the noise on planes, and I think actually we went over this before in another article, the noise on planes actually reduces the sensation of salt, sour, and bitter, okay? But tomato products like tomato juice depend for their attraction on umami, which is not affected by noise. So there are little, you know, notes like this in this book called Gastrophysics. It comes down to, though, is a phrase, a quote from the Roman poet Horace from 2,000 years ago, who said, "The chief pleasure in eating consists of not costly seasoning or exquisite flavor, but yourself." Okay, which we've talked about before. And I should say, on another note in the Wall Street Journal, the wine critic, Letty Tigg, did an article about wine sort of trends and you know, how they start up, how long they last, which ones are coming. She refers to the popularity of Pinot Noir.
Right.
Which you may realize began with, the movie Sideways.
Right.
And is still running strong from there. And actually, she mentions a rage for Moscato, a sparkling wine, amongst the hip-hop crowd.
Well, your crowd.
It was
the crowd with which you're intimately familiar.
By Drake.
Yeah.
Rap star Drake. And others. And so Moscato gets this huge bounce.
And yet, notwithstanding Drake's drinking...
And I actually had Moscato for the first time.
But it had nothing to do with
Drake. Down in Flowery Branch. Yeah. Nothing to do with Drake. Finally I'm catching up.
Yeah.
Not my favorite.
Yeah.
It's a little sweet. I wasn't expecting that. It was actually a rosé. A sparkling rosé Moscato. I can see how it could be a fun drink for certain situations. It didn't really
rock
my world.
It's not surprising that's the way those food trends start, but we'll just have to keep our eye on it.
But no good ideas about what the next ones are. So,
well, here's something that's moving around. I don't know how it's going to move, but apparently the bidding for cheddar, the cheese auction, traditional cheese auctions are changing, and you say to yourself, cheese auctions? What's a cheese auction? Well, people for years have been having cheese auctions at the Wisconsin Cheese Exchange, in which a bunch of guys with cards have been bidding for the price of cheddar cheese.
Right.
And I had no idea that went on.
So I mean, I don't really get it. I can't. Well, even here's imagine.
Let me give you 1 minute on it because there's news to me.
Like, only 1 minute.
Only 1 minute. But people, these guys bid for the price of what they call normal cheddar cheese. They ended up with the CME spot cheddar price, and everything's priced off that. Not only is better cheddar, but other cheeses. In other words, mozzarella is cheddar plus a dime. That's the way they sell it.
And yeah, but does that mean like the bobolink farm up the road here?
No, obviously not. You know, obviously not. But I'm talking about...
It charges $24 a pound
for their artisanal cheese? I'm talking about grocery cheese and stuff like that.
Okay.
Grocery store cheese.
It's a commodity thing.
Yes, exactly.
So are we sad that they're not standing on the floor shouting,
it's going digital? They are switching. They're still going to have the cheese auction. It's going to be electronic. It's not going to be manual anymore. But the quote... That sums it up is the guy who's the options trader who's been running it for a long time says, quote, we're all going to miss the yelling and the screaming. So, you know, it's the same thing parents say when the kids go to school. Yeah.
Back to the New York Times.
Right.
The Metropolitan section. Big headline.
Yeah.
New York City's great scenic ride.
Yeah.
California has the Pacific Coast Highway, the Southwest, its historic Route 66. New York, our great drive may be the Belt Parkway, whose 25 miles hug both green space and stunning coastline on its tractor-trailer-free run through South Brooklyn and Eastern Queens. Yeah. Okay, low-slung and curvaceous, the Belt is lined with world-class views, and when it comes right down to it, not the worst place to be stuck at sunset.
Yeah. Well, it is, first of all, a likely place to be stuck at sunset. Not the worst place. It is a parking lot. It is, I would say,
the bane of our weekend existence.
It is one of the circles of hell in Dante's Inferno.
Oh!
It is a brutal outpost of poor planning. And the person who wrote this article was assigned to get the one day.
There are some fun things along it. I always enjoy when we go by the Riding Academy. You know, the idea that here in the middle of this traffic,
I don't think it's
there
fun.
Are these
I think
horses
it's incongruous.
Going around in a ring and people going to their.
I think it's the idea that when we are so miserable, that there are people who are less miserable.
But there is, you know, there's all kinds of construction going on.
Oh, it's
you
terrible.
Cannot. I'm
it's,
sure there are beautiful things to see, but it's really hard to see them. There are a couple of nice hills that actually used to be landfills.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's still landfills, but they're
just
all
say,
grown.
I would like to have the Belt Parkway's present.
But the cutest thing about the article is there is the map that shows the Belt Parkway,
and
they outline it in red.
Yeah.
And you know, when you're on Google Maps,
it's
the traffic
is in red. Yeah.
And so that's perfectly fitting, I think, as a way to picture.
Yes, the Belt Parkway is awful.
Yes. But, you know, who knew?
Okay.
Some people are actually appreciating it.
I doubt
probably
it.
Because they don't have to drive on it. Okay, so now you probably want to hear about slow art.
Yeah, that's what I was hoping.
So I would like to tell you about slow art. And actually, this is from a review of a book by Arden Reed, who's a professor at Pomona out in California. And it's addressing the experience of looking at art, and again, trying to slow it down, the way we have slow food.
Yeah, because art moves too quickly, generally. That's been my complaint.
Yeah, well, it's not that. It's just, you know, he's commenting on people run in, they, you know, look at something for 5 seconds and move on. Actually, I'm not sure I agree with the premise of slow art.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's the viewer that can make art slow. I don't think art... in and of itself, decides to be slow. It, you know, anything, I think, can be slow if it fascinates you, right? That's the trick of it. But what's fun is he mentions a bunch of other things, a bunch of other interesting things to look at, not necessarily high art, but low art. One of the things he mentions is the tableau vivant, the pageant that's out in Laguna Beach every summer, where they recreate entire paintings with live people in these stage settings. Mm-hmm. And that seems kind of fun. Okay?
Yeah. Right.
And I was once in the area during when that was going on, but I could not get a ticket. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting that we would feel the need and the satisfaction of acting out famous works of art.
Right.
He also talks about the Stereopticon,
right,
which was all the rage in the late 19th, early 20th century, and that is a kind of earlier version of the Viewmaster.
Right.
Okay, which, you know, were those binocular things that you'd look, you had that little disc,
mm-hmm,
that you put in and you look through, and it could make, it would show you these different scenes.
No, my aunt had a Stereopticon on Ocean Parkway in the 1960s.
Right, so that was a handheld thing that actually had two lenses. You look through the lenses, and it held, you put in a card,
mm-hmm,
with two pictures,
mm-hmm,
of a scene, and when you looked through the lenses, it made the scene appear three-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there were touristic, you know, famous sites, monuments, stories, jokes. There were even naughty pictures. In the end,
my aunt did not.
It wanes.
Yeah,
you don't know. She probably had a special cabinet somewhere,
yeah,
or perhaps, you know, Uncle Leo.
Yeah.
Let's
keep Uncle Leo out of it.
But
yeah.
Anyway, so that, you know, that's kind of a fun thing to think about. In the end, the concept failed. It was taken, all these cards were made with a camera that actually had two lenses,
right,
to take a picture of the same scene from slightly different angles,
mm-hmm,
and that's what made it seem 3D. And I understand that 3D, the technology,
sure,
for 3D movies today uses a similar concept on it. And, it, you know, the book also mentions Lady Hamilton, who was the mistress, you know, who was the mistress of Lord Nelson,
right,
and quite a character in Naples back in the day, dressing up like a Greek woman and doing her own little tableaus and acting out different kinds of emotions and things. So it seems like a fun book. I'm not sure exactly where it takes us, but he talks about a lot of interesting things. So that's Arden Reed, Slow Art.
All right. Well, as we head toward the end of this, I did want to mention one other sports story. And the headline is, veteran Blackhawks star to miss next season because of skin disorder. And it's an article about Marian Hossa, who's been in the league for many years, and is a big star. It's a big story with the Chicago Blackhawks. I would say one of the top 10 players in the NHL. And he's going to miss next season because he's allergic to the hockey equipment. And, you know, I've heard a couple people on the radio kind of get a chuckle out of this and just at least say, this doesn't make any sense. How can he be allergic to the equipment? But I remembered when you played hockey, Tamsin, back in college,
back
that
in
was
the 70s,
a thing.
There was a big, the gunk.
And they say,
yeah,
gunk here.
Yeah.
The creeping crud is the technical
term.
Yeah,
from the 70s. And actually, oddly enough, I played ice hockey at Princeton in the 70s.
Yeah.
And I had the gunk. But I had inherited my shin guards from my older brother, who played club hockey up at Clarkson Tech.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure that I then gave these shin guards, when I was done with them, to my younger brother, Bryce,
mm-hmm,
who, you know, still plays ice hockey. And he's over 60.
But
I don't know if he has the gun.
Yeah, that's what
I don't know if he
sticking with the
gun.
Disease. The
he
point,
has not mentioned.
But
it.
What was interesting was it was a mystery back then, and X years later, it's a mystery now. This is,
yeah,
the highest level of sports for hockey. It's the NHL. Is one of the biggest stars, and obviously he's gotten expert medical help, and it's still a mystery.
You would think with modern science.
And there's,
yeah,
no answer for it. There's something. It's not even sure which piece of the equipment creates the skin allergy, but it's enough to destroy this person's career. So it's just totally odd, but it's real. All right, so we're going to close with I'd like to read from a letter to the New York Times, which was in response to a column by David Brooks. David Brooks writes an op-ed piece for the Times, and Tamsin's read a book by David Brooks. And he writes about the social sciences quite a bit. And he writes quite a bit about ethics and values and how that might be informed by religion or not. And he has a broader set of observations than that, to be sure. But he wrote a column, in this case, on failures in fatherhood, the phenomenon of dads not following through and taking care of their biological children, and how that's really a failure of values. And if a society were to respond by enhancing the compelling nature of values in society, then you wouldn't have this phenomenon so much. And the letter is in response to that. And it's by a person who says that that he's involved with a nonprofit that's had some success on this issue. It has a so-called fatherhood initiative, but he differs with Brooks on what the cause of the problem is. And I'll just read from the letter. Quote, "The dads I meet in these programs have the same motivations that I do as a parent. They want their kids to benefit from them. They want mom to see the value of their input, and they want the feeling of self-worth that comes from being an engaged dad. The causes of estrangement from their kids are varied and complicated, but the underlying current to all of their stories is chronic generational poverty. Values and a sense of responsibility, while important, are not the panacea. As with any illness, it's always better to treat the cause and not just the symptoms." So that's the response to Brooks. And what's interesting is the letter is by Jerry Seinfeld.
The Jerry Seinfeld?
The Times helpfully says, right to the bottom of the letter, the writer is the comedian. But it's just neat when you see something like that in the New York Times and you just say, well, here's another guy living in New York just engaging in a dialogue that exists, you know, on various levels, including writing back to the New York Times.
Okay, so we're happy to engage in a dialogue.
And we will next week.
Meanwhile, you know, if you remember, you might want to subscribe to the podcast so you make sure you get every episode.
That's right.
Right when it's posted.
And that way we'll keep the royalties coming.
And if you think about it too, maybe you want to like put in a review with iTunes.
Oh man, you're really in promotional gear here.
I am in promotional gear.
All right. Well, right. I'm all for that. Well,
just to enhance the dialogue.
Just to enhance the dialogue, yeah. So thanks for listening, and we'll be with you next week on Tamsin Dan Read the Paper.
See you then.